Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Rhiannon Evans, and with me today is classicist, author, and Cambridge University professor, Mary Beard. She's the author of many popular and respected works, including her newest book, Emperor of Rome, which explores the power and practices of the rulers of ancient Rome. This brings me to episode CCXXXVIII, Imperial Dining. The simple act of dinner took on a new dimension for the emperors. In a place where every meal could be a performance, an emperor used the chance to reward and impress, intimidate and strike fear, and sometimes all at once. Having dinner with the emperor was always a great honor, but sometimes you were risking your life. Here's Mary Beard.
Dinners for me are really fascinating, Roman imperial dinners, because in some ways, when we read about them in Roman writers, they do live up to the whole Hollywood image, you know, that overconsumption, recipes made out of the most extraordinary, and we would say totally repulsive ingredients, you know, all sorts of things stuffed into pigs' bladders that we would never fancy stuffing. What's interesting is that we and the Romans share that sense that when the emperor sat down to dinner, it was over the top. Now, I suppose that's not all that different from what we imagine in modern monarchies, really, that the royals, you know, always eat fantastically rich, lavish things that are way outside our price range. And it's probably not true. And in some ways, in Rome, it wasn't true either. I think that emperors and people who write about emperors in the ancient world, they're kind of invested in the idea that the emperor eats differently from normal, ordinary people. And I'm sure he makes a show of doing that occasionally. I'm sure that you could go to dinners and, you know, there would be five poor enslaved people kind of trundling in some vast animal which had been sort of prepared in a very weird way. So I don't think it's entirely untrue, but I think that there are quite a few reasons for thinking that it wasn't the norm.
Yes, I mean, it would be a huge production every day. I know in your book you talk about one problem with this is that the kitchens didn't seem to be particularly large.
I kind of imagine, you know, some of it is the ancient equivalent of a takeaway. By takeaway, we means it was prepared somewhere very much on the margins of imperial property. But I think what struck me when I was writing the book, and when I was just thinking harder about this than I'd done before, you look at what a Roman dining room looks like and how people ate. And you can see that what they're doing is that they're eating lying down, propped up on one arm, the other arm free. No real table often. I mean, it's more of a kind of ledge, maybe a table sort of within reach, but they're not sitting with a big kind of place serving. And they've got wine. They don't have a fork because forks haven't really been invented. So you've got this image of this great beast coming in, often a very meaty centre, I'm afraid. And you think, well, how do they actually eat that? Now, I suspect that an awful lot of that imperial dining and the cuisine attached to it was very much for show. You know, I imagine that it's brought in with huge razzmatazz. But if these men and women are actually going to eat it, then it's going to have to be cut up, right? So I imagine that on the few occasions that this happens, there's, you know, big drum roll, in it comes, a real display of servers or whatever. But it's been kind of cut up into sort of bite-sized pieces by the time it gets to anyone who's going to eat it. So, you know, I did say in the book, I think in some ways we ought to think about this as tapas, because how else are you going to consume it? So I think it's a funny mixture between, and I think this goes for a lot of imperial society, honestly, a sort of show. But when you get down to the everyday reality, it's not that it's entirely wrong. It's just that you didn't sit down with a great knife and fork and a huge plate, kind of meat and two vegetables. You had to be given little things.
Yes. So one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you about this is we did a kind of introductory podcast recording on dining. So we've done some of the background on the layout of the dining room, but not particularly about imperial dinners. And we did kind of come up against that. How would you eat this? And tapas was one of the things we brought up. And the cutting it up makes me think of what you do for little children almost. But of course, then they do have presumably hordes of enslaved people to do that for them if needed. I was fascinated by a lot of the things you said there and wanted to move on to that idea of spectacle and what our sources are presenting and maybe giving us that idea of this being regular with some of the emperors. So I wondered if we could talk about how these kind of dinners might be presented as a reflection of emperors' characters, whether there are any specific examples of emperors being demonized or maybe frugal dinners are a good thing or maybe a bad thing. I don't know.
Well, I think that it is in a way spectacle and theatre, and it is where the emperor is on show to the members of the elite in close quarters. And if you look at the layout of the dining rooms, you see that, in a sense, Hadrian's villa, for example, at Tivoli, one of the dining rooms, and there are many, but is in front of an enormous, or now seems enormous, kind of canal of water in which the emperor is seated at one end, raised up with his guests around him and beneath him, I think. He's being looked at. I think there's no doubt that there's this feeling that dinner is where you are being seen, not being seen like you were when you went to the Colosseum. This is not a public occasion, though sometimes you get the feeling when emperors go out and eat in rather more curious places, they do choose public places, and you do suspect, or we know in some cases, that people turned up to have a look, just like they turned up at Versailles to see, the French kings tucking in. And there is one rather kind of poignant reported remark, how true it is, we don't know, from the 3rd century Alexander Severus, who says that when he's dining, he feels like he's at the theatre. He's on show at the theatre. So there is that sense of this being display. And I think it relates quite interestingly to conventions of theatre. There's a wonderful dining room, which we are 99% certain was built for and used by Nero on the Palatine, and quite soon gets covered up by the later palace. And there, in fact, the imperial party actually look out onto a stage. There is a kind of stage there where no doubt all sorts of other spectacles get presented, whether it's stand-up comedy or musicians or philosophical disputations. And so you've got that sense of everybody knowing that people are being looked at, which I think is absolutely crucial in terms of how these dinners are described. Now, I think it's quite hard for the emperor to do right in them. And of course, it's quite hard for the emperor to do right ever, really, because he either is too extravagant. How could you imagine that someone would be so ridiculously wasteful as Elagabalus, for example, at the beginning of the 3rd century? He has color-coded dinners, so that everything served is either blue or it's red or whatever. Now, he's not the only Roman to have tried that, but he's the one who gets quite a lot of PR for it. And also this sense that it's very, very easy to go too far. I think it is very easy to go too far. And the luxury is partly envious luxury when it's reported, but it's also partly a sense that how unbelievably wasteful it is to that kind of imperial dining. But you can't necessarily win the other way, because if you're too sort of modest, you get a frightful reputation for meanness. Now, sometimes, You can hit it right, apparently, particularly if you've got a friend explaining it. The Emperor Trajan, according to Pliny, was very good because he had sort of simple suppers where people came and joined in, as if almost as if they were equals sitting around. Fine. But poor old Tiberius, he's supposed to have served up leftovers the next day. And you think, well, that's very sensible, maybe you had a large boar and there's some left, and serve it up again, mate. That was insulting. The idea that you could go to dinner with the emperor and you'd get kind of cast-offs from the previous day. So you're being looked at if you're the emperor, but you're also being judged, and you're being judged by what you serve, but you're also being judged by how you treat your guests. Now, Tiberius gets falls into very bad odour by serving up the leftovers. On the other hand, he's very good in other respects. He greets his guests. When they go to leave, he gets up and says, oh, goodbye, goodbye, how lovely to see you. So there is a kind of sense about how you behave as host. Whether you're like Caligula, you're supposed to, I don't necessarily believe this, you're supposed to take other people's wives off, try and take them to bed between courses. But also, you can be too vicious to the servants, too humiliating to the other guests. There are stories about enslaved servants getting punished by having their hands cut off. Now, again, we don't know if this is true, but at some level, it doesn't matter whether it's true because it's how you believe an emperor could behave. And yet, there's a wonderful story, I think it's about Claudius, where some guy comes to dinner one evening and everybody can spot that he's nicked one of the silver plates. He's being served. And you know what you do at a restaurant sometimes, oh, no, we shouldn't say this, but the stories that people, they walk off with, a rather nice spoon or something. Well, this guy walked off with a rather beautiful silver plate. Here, Claudius gets kind of a good rep because what he does is he does nothing. He just lets it go, just lets it go. Next time the guy comes to supper, everybody else is being served off silver plates and he's being served off pottery plates.
Not to be trusted. So I really like the range of ways that the emperor could be evaluated there. I mean, one thing it strikes me is that it's an opportunity for the emperor to display his humor, as in the final case that you suggested there. But with somebody like, I mean, it's great for Trajan because he's always got Pliny to say nice things about him. And you kind of need that, don't you? Whereas Nero has got Tacitus and Suetonius sticking the knife in. It seems like everything Nero does is going to be too much. And we get this idea of his reign as being entirely theatrical. And of course, it's maybe the kind of dinner that's being satirized by Petronius in the dinner with Trimalchio. There's a game element going on sometimes, which might be entertaining or might be kind of terrifying. I don't know.
To some extent, it goes on in our own haute cuisine. There are rather limited things you can do with food ingredients. One of the things you can do if you've got more money than you need is you can turn food into things that is not it, right? And that even goes down to the kind of recipes you find in the one surviving, and it's quite a puzzling one, the one surviving Roman cookery book by Apicius. Now, we don't know when this was written, and it's probably a bit like Mrs. Beaton. It's a kind of cookery book which kind of gradually grows and people add recipes to it, and but it still goes under the name of Apicius. Well, there's one wonderful recipe in that which kind of also hits on this because it's a pate, perhaps, a patina of anchovies without anchovies. And it says at the end of this recipe, at table, no one will know what they're eating. They won't realize that there are no anchovies. And so today if we could afford to go to the kind of restaurants that we can't afford to go to, we would find all sorts of cucumber made to look as if it was sausage or something. That's part of the joke. Throughout history, I think, of haute cuisine, and the Romans are certainly one of the biggest exponents of that.
Yes. So I wonder if we could talk now about how sometimes dining with the emperor could be very dangerous. So you've mentioned that it could be definitely dangerous for enslaved people, but as you've mentioned, most of the sources we have are senatorial or at least equestrian, which I guess they really concentrate on how they get treated because of that. So it's important that it is the emperor kind of dining with that level of society. And sometimes in sources we have, it seems like you might be lucky to get out with your life if you dine with the emperor. I don't know if you want to start with Domitian's dangerous dinners, which that doesn't end in death, but it looks like it will.
In a way, the Roman imperial dinner party is the kind of traditional crime scene, the cliched crime scene. I mean, it reminds me of sort of, you pick up an Agatha Christie book and you suddenly discovered you're in the vicarage and you sort of know the vicarage is going to be the source of crime. Well, there's a fair bet that if you are reading a Roman history book and you suddenly have a description of a dinner party, what is going to happen is nasty. This is the cliche version of the scene of the crime. And it comes in very, very many different forms. And it comes sometimes, almost as a parody of itself. So there is a wonderful story of the Emperor Domitian at the end of the first century CE. And he decides he's going to invite some leading Romans to dinner. They get the invitations. They, I suppose, imagine, oh, yippee, dinner with the emperor. When they go, it becomes all the more creepy. They discover that the whole dining room is painted black. All the food that is served is the kind of food you eat at kind of funeral banquets. Beside each couch, there is a silver plaque with the guest's name on it, but it's shaped like a tombstone. And Domitian is talking all the time about death, on and on about death. And they think, blimey, we're not going to get out of here alive. Last hour has come. They eat their food as best they can. They listen to the emperor and are absolutely terrified. At a certain point, Domitian says, "Very nice evening. Thank you very much." And they get taken home. And they think to start with, phew, got out of that alive. They go in, in modern terms, they now don't, no doubt pour themselves a stiff drink to recover. But whatever they did, they soon hear a knock at the door, the proverbial knock at the door. And they think, oh my goodness, this is it. So they go to the door, but they don't find a hit squad. They find an imperial staff bearing gifts, including the silver tombstone that had been next to each of them, and also bringing them as a present the enslaved servant who had served them the meal. During the meal, these poor people had been covered in black to match the black theme of the dinner party. But as we're told by Dio, who describes this, they'd been washed down, they're all nice, and they were part of the present. Now, I think the thing that jumps out at us is the slave, actually. It is what kind of world is it in which you give enslaved people to your guests as a going away present, right? I mean, when I was telling this story to some friends of mine, they said, well, you wouldn't do that with a load of kittens. You wouldn't have people to dinner and say, oh, do take a kitten away. Right? That it's so beyond what we think of as the nature of gift giving. But within the Roman context, because we know other cases where enslaved people are given as gifts, it's obviously playing with the idea of the dinner party as a place of danger and death. Again, it's not entirely out of line with other bits of Roman culture. We know, for example, that Trimalchio in the dinner party scene in Petronius's Satyricon, he has his tombstone brought in as a kind of centerpiece. I think it's Seneca who tells the story of one guy who thinks he has to practice for his funeral every day. So every dinner party is a kind of funeral rehearsal. So it's not totally out of line, but is enormously exaggerated here. And it has a sort of happy ending. It's saying danger, death goes with the dinner party. And we see that in other cases where the ending isn't so happy. The dinner party is where you put people to death.
Just before you move on to that, I wonder if we could just spend a couple more minutes picking apart what's going on with Domitian, or we think might be going on with Domitian. When you were talking, I was thinking of Trimalchio, and of course, it doesn't work time-wise for Petronius to be satirizing Domitian, but I was thinking, I wonder if Domitian had read Petronius. But it sounds like this discussion of death at dinner is a trope throughout, that it's not direct line there. I've always thought with that passage from Dio, well, for one thing, it's only in Dio. Suetonius doesn't mention it. We don't know with Tacitus, we don't have that part of Tacitus. Does that make it less likely? Maybe, but then by then Suetonius's biographies are getting a bit short. But also, is this the emperor just showing his power, or is it part of that display and kind of a very sophisticated, or it sort of makes me think of 1960s beat stuff. Maybe that's all the black clothing. How would you read it?
Well, I think it's hard. And I mean, you're right to say we only hear it from one source. It's a story that every modern ancient historian loves, and yet it only comes in one account. The thing about these accounts is that if you don't worry too much about whether they're true, I have some curiosity about whether they're true, but I think the much more important thing is that they're told and that people presumably go on telling these and they believe them and they read them. It deserves a lot of attention as actually a very vivid story. I think that my feeling with it and my doubts about it are slightly different from yours. I think that it's obviously told by Dio. He's writing a long time after the reign of Domitian. Domitian, by that stage, has become a kind of almost caricature monster. And Dio's account of Domitian has plenty of that caricature in it. That's all true. What do we imagine we would say if we were telling that story from Domitian's point of view, if it was not an attack on a manipulative and sadistic emperor, even without shedding blood? Well, I think that we might say, what a brilliant fancy dress party. I'm really clever, aren't I? Says Domitian. Got this brilliant idea for fancy dress. And of course, he took them all in. How funny, right? So it's a sort of joke gone wrong. Or you can say, and this is kind of picking up Seneca's description of the man who, as it were, feels he has to practice, not just for his funeral, but for his death each day, that this is a philosophical lesson. We go to dinner with the emperor. And now here I'm going to be the support of Domitian. He was really brilliant. You know what he did? He really made us think about the shortness of life. And he did that partly by giving us a lesson from his own mouth of the shortness of life, but reminding us of it by the way the room had been decorated. I mean, it was really, really an important pitch about the inevitability of death. Now, we also know dining is connected with dying in all kinds of ways, not just, what we learn about the show off Trimalchio showing off his tombstone, but we have drinking cups with skeletons on them. We have mosaics from the center of dining room floors in the shape of skeletons saying, the slogan we still have, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow you die. We can never get to the bottom of these stories, but we can see how they might have been told differently.
If only he'd been Marcus Aurelius, whose reputation is only as wise. And Domitian's reputation, of course, is as entirely paranoid, hence having the palace with the reflective marble. So, although he didn't see it coming when it came in the end. And it is really interesting. And I love that alternative reading as well, and how it isn't just a, oh, you could see it like this, but also reflects other kinds of cultural moves that are going on in Rome, that this suggestion that you do think about this. And I always love a Seneca reference because he is so above it all, isn't he? The man who thought he could live in poverty by doing it a few days a year. If we could talk now about some of the dinners where it didn't end so well, you were right to be worried about going to dinner with the emperor because, yeah, it didn't all end happily.
No, it is the crime scene. And, I think often of the story told by Tacitus of the death of Britannicus, Nero's younger stepbrother. It's a wonderful, however accurate, evocation of an imperial dinner party. And actually, it's quite a family party because the kids are there too. And the kids, Tacitus says, it's interesting for dining practice. The kids, including Britannicus, are sat at a separate table. And Nero is dead jealous of Britannicus because he suspects that Nero has just taken the throne. He is the son of Agrippina, but only the adopted son of the Emperor Claudius. Britannicus is Claudius's biological son. And Nero, we are told, feels that Britannicus is a potential threat. Britannicus is eating with them and he suddenly keels over and dies. Tacitus has an explanation of how this was done, that they'd poured poison into the water with which the wine of Britannicus was diluted. And he's taken out. Now, what I think is so chilling about that scene, as Tacitus describes it, and it reflects back on the dinner party, is that it's not just that Britannicus is dead, it's how do the other guests react? And in a sense, some of them panic. Some of them look at Nero, very bad idea to suggest that he might be responsible. Others kind of run around. They think, oh my God, Britannicus is dead. And the only person who does it right is Britannicus's sister, Octavia. And what does she do? She just keeps on eating as if nothing had happened. And you sort of see then the way that the dinner party and death at dinner party encapsulates that sense that imperial power actually totally undermines human relations. Octavia gets it right in the rules of the party. But what that means is that she doesn't pay a blind bit of attention when her only brother has just keeled over and died. Now, Nero, of course, says he's epileptic and he has these fits and terribly sorry. And then Tacitus rather kind of archly says people might have believed that, except the funeral pyre had already been prepared.
Terrifying, isn't it? Yeah. Octavia's reaction is just very telling there that she's cut off from her emotions. She's so young at that stage. I can't remember exactly how old she is, but mid-teens probably. And she's already learned that this is how you behave around the emperor if something like this happens at dinner.
And it does happen at dinner. And even when it doesn't happen, you're constantly reminded that it might happen by the presence of food tasters. Now, assuming Tacitus is right, we have no reason to believe or not believe this.
They are brought up a lot, aren't they? I mean, the mention of the food tasters, the pre-tasters, is elsewhere too.
Yeah, they are. And, Tacitus provides an excuse for why they didn't preempt the murder of Britannicus.
I love this because this brings us back to Agatha Christie. I'm pretty sure this is used in several 1930s murder mysteries. This kind of it's added at a different time, but please do tell it because it's magnificent.
Rhiannon, I think you probably know more about this than me. So if you're describing this in your Tacitus, you've got to provide a way of explaining how it was that the food tasters, who are there in abundance at imperial dinner parties, why didn't they, if he's poisoned, why didn't they discover it? Well, that's because it was put in the water, not in the wine. It always strikes me is that the mere presence of food tasters must be a reminder that you might be about to be poisoned. And so the whole kind of ambience of the feast is a combination of you going to dinner with the emperor is big news, you know, even for a, you know, the average senator, it's what you want to do, you know. And people write very enthusiastically about their dinners with the emperor. But there's also the sense that it might not end well. And you can never forget that. You know, as soon as you go, if we went to dinner where there was a load of food tasters, we'd kind of wonder, wouldn't we, what was about to happen? I used to tell this story with gay abandon until I thought it was quite funny in a way, the idea of the food taster. Very Roman, you know, perhaps very 18th century, but not 21st century. I happened to be staying, and I won't say which country it was. I was staying in a nice hotel where one evening the president of that country came to dinner. I was not part of the party, but the next morning I asked the head of the hotel, the owner of the hotel, had it been a problem? You know, was it, you know, a bit of a big deal having the president? And he said, no, it was really nice. It was a bit odd having the food tasters. And I thought, I have been so naive. You know, food tasters must actually be part of the modern world as well. Now, he said, look, the food taster in this case went into the kitchen and had all the kitchen equipment on, the white hat and everything. So he didn't stand out, but food tasters.
The level of trust is rock bottom.
We still worry about, you know, because it's a very easy place. Kill someone.
Yes. And we do expect a level of trust when we're coming together and sharing this occasion. Absolutely. It does loom over that story and others. And it also kind of ups the level of kind of manipulation and planning in that story. Sorry to come back to the murder mysteriness of it, but the fact that the drink has been made too hot so that he will ask for water to be added. Definite premeditation, obviously, because there's poison on hand. Interesting that this is kind of a side tangent, but the kind of origin of the poisons always seems to be a woman, doesn't it? There's always a woman poisoner kind of scheming in the background and providing it to these evil players.
Because, you know, the association of women with poison is really interesting because it goes beyond, you know, Roman imperial shenanigans. And you kind of think, yeah, poisoning is sort of the absolute inverse of what women are supposed to do. Women are supposed to nurture you with their food. And of course, when things go wrong, they kill you. So it's kind of inverse cookery.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great point. All right. I think we've got time for one last tale, which you're telling so brilliantly. I wonder if we could finish with a character you've already mentioned, with Elagabalus, which is one of my favorite stories of a fatal dinner, and maybe resonant because it's also the subject of a famous painting by Alma Tadema, if I'm remembering correctly. So, could you tell us about the weird dinner that you might be invited to by the Emperor Elagabalus, also known as Heliogabalus, in the early 3rd century?
Yeah, here we are in the early 3rd century. He's a young Syrian emperor. He's a teenager, actually. And he's been kind of manipulated onto the throne by the family of the wife of Septimius Severus, Julia Domna, Syrian by origin. And I suppose if we're going to think about Gladiator 2, he's the guy who's put on the throne after they get rid of Macrinus, who has a big role in Gladiator 2. And there is an extremely fantastical biography written a couple of centuries later of Elagabalus, which is, you know, probably as flagrantly untrue as any biography could be, but is absolutely brilliant because it somehow is a magnifying lens onto all the faults and vices of Roman emperors. I mean, so that if you think Nero is bad, you go to Elagabalus and you discover that Nero is a pussycat compared with this guy. And one of the main sights of his wickedness is his dinner parties. And so you see the perverted dinner party in huge magnification. And it goes from his humiliating treatment of his guests, so that the guests are rigidly hierarchized, and the lower status guests only get fake food it's only the high status guests who get real food. Now, and that's also not heard about in Roman history for the first time with Elagabalus, but he's the kind of the main culprit. So you've got some wooden apples in front of you while the people on the top table, as it were, are eating real apples. And he has jokes at his guests' expense. So he puts a load of fat men on a couch so that they can't fit and they fall off. Ha ha, you know?
Really is a teenager.
Yeah, he is. I mean, it is very much teenage stuff. But he appears to invent the whoopee cushion, because the other thing he does is he has inflatable cushions put on the couches for them to sit on. Those cushions get deflated during the evening and the guys end up on the floor. Ha ha. But the wonderful and chilling and terrifying story that is captured by the painting of Alma Tadema is the story of him having elite guests to dinner, and at the end of the evening, kind of as a bit comatose because they've had quite a lot to drink, he lets rose petals fall from the ceiling. Again, a nice Roman trick, very theatrical. But in Elagabalus's case, he lets so many rose petals fall from the ceiling that they smother and die. And Alma Tadema's painting captures that moment of them sort of realizing that this isn't going to end very well. Now, for me, I think it's quite a good anecdote because we know it cannot possibly be true. You cannot smother people with rose petals. That is impossible, right? So we know it's not true. So it really does kind of free you up, because you're not worried about whether it's true or not. It frees you up to think, well, what's the point of it? You know, what is the point of it? And to some extent, I think it takes you back to some of the virtues and vices of the emperor, some of the deceptive qualities of the emperor. And I think that there's a very clear message here, that that story gets told because it reminds us that when the emperor is at his most dinner partily generous, he is also at his most dangerous. He's killing with kindness. And it's just pointing you in, I think, in the direction of a bigger picture about how you can ever interact with a man in this position, how you can ever trust it, how you can believe your eyes, how you can make the judgments that you ordinarily make about ordinary people. They just don't work when you come to the emperor. The emperor's kindness kills you.
Yeah, and it's so expensive. I mean, rose petals are still very expensive. If you want to buy rose oil, it's one of the most expensive ones. So it is part of the extravagance as well. And the painting, I mean, people should go Google it if you haven't seen it, with the emperor and his small entourage on a raised platform. He's really thought about, I can't remember if this is in the Historia Augusta biography, but thought about the mechanics of this. Because if it were to happen, and I'm absolutely with you, I don't think it is plausible at all, then it takes, again, a lot of planning, because presumably you've got these rose petals up in nets and you've weighed out how many it would take to bury those guests at the lower platform, but not you high up there. And he's just, you know, lounging there, watching, enjoying this kind of luxuriant death.
It is a riff on the idea that one of the ways of showing extravagant generosity in Roman dining was to let things fall from the ceiling. There's a painting in Pompeii which shows fruit in nets, I think obviously meant to be nets that would let the fruit out. And when Domitian holds a fantastic, well, it's a kind of grand picnic, really, in the Colosseum, one of the tricks he plays is he puts a net across the Colosseum. I mean, he's reusing the Colosseum, not for gladiatorial shows here, but for dining. And everybody is sitting as if they were at the gladiatorial shows, but they're being served a huge picnic. But from above, the net lets down fruit onto their heads. And in fact, the joke is that some of the fruit isn't particularly ripe, and so people kind of get nasty bumps from the you know, unripe pears coming down from on high. But it's the same idea.
Thanks to our guest, classicist and author, Professor Mary Beard. And you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and other available podcast platforms. You can like Emperors of Rome on Facebook, and you can follow us on Blue Sky. Mary is at W. Mary Beard. I am at Dr. Rhiannon, and the podcast is at Rome Podcast. This podcast is produced at the Bundoora campus of La Trobe University on the traditional land of the Wurundjeri people. So until the next episode, I'm Rhiannon Evans, and thanks for listening.